Okay, I would like to do this. So as you can see, it's good to deal with texts. You know, like the woman asked me on the airplane, give me an example of a canon. And the only way we're going to have meaningful discussion is, when we have discussion, is to actually be engaged with the texts of canon law. And that's why we're doing case studies. I don't have time to go through all the case studies in the canon law case study book. I apologize, they're my own translations, 99% of the time. And obviously, every translation is a interpretation. We're trying to put it into the medium of what, you know, our own language. And there's debate about it because I come out of it with a certain perspective and a certain analysis because I'm engaged with the text. And I, you know, this is something to consider when you read a translation. Now, what I'd like to do is talk about, we'd like to continue with the understanding the general sources of canon law. It's important for us, if we're going to have further discussion, to have a common base of knowledge. Some of you may have a very advanced state of knowledge about the history of the development of canon law, but I would like to cover a few topics, one of which I promised, which was the relationship between in the Byzantine period, where many sources of church legislation were developed, the relationship or common life between the church and the Roman state. And there's one terminology I do not want to hear, at least I've heard it, the symphony. Okay, that word symphony, it's just not in any of the sources. And I'd like to talk about the imperial legislation as a source of canonical legislation, why it would be. Obviously, in the context of the Roman Empire, the church grew up first as a persecuted religion that resisted emperor worship and thus integration into the imperial ideology. Then after toleration, and eventually under the Emperor Theodosius, who is the emperor from 379 to 395, it's given the status of an official religion and becomes an ideological, from the standpoint of critical study, it becomes an ideological foundation, some say, for the Roman state. And I'm making wide generalizations here, guys. With the Muslim conquests beginning in the 7th century, there is an increased emphasis on the importance of Constantinople in administrative, legislative, and judicial affairs. It simply happens. The other ancient patriarchates live on, but they do not hold their former importance in concilia and other discussions in many ways. They continue their lives with less ability to take independent initiatives, most evident in Alexandria, where they are hard put in the 12th century to solve some basic canonical and theological issues, particularly with regard to matrimonial legislation, which is enjoying a very large production under the Patriarchate of Constantinople, and they asked 66 questions. Ironically, it is the Patriarch of Antioch that frames the answers, because that Patriarch of Antioch is in this theater of Balsamon, is probably the greatest canonical and legal mind our church has ever produced. And he frames these answers that are issued in the name of the great church. Now, did all of this mean that as the official religion in the Roman Empire of the East, that the church was a government department? And this was untrue for many reasons, and there's a lot of There's a lot of study of this by Byzantinists, and particularly the great Byzantinist by the name of Gilbert d'Agron, who is a French Byzantinist. He writes a seminal work, really, that I would strongly represent, Emperor and Priest. Emperor and Priest. And he provides a very good basis to understand things. Is the church a government department? No, I would say for a variety of reasons. The emperor was not worshipped. He held a unique position as Christ's representative, responsible for good government of the empire. This included responsibility for civil and canon law. In the words of the novel 109 of Justinian the Great, who is the emperor from 525 to 565, if we make every effort to enforce the civil laws, how much more should we not try to enforce the canons and the divine laws designed for the salvation of souls? The emperor is regarded as established by God and given by him, but this did not mean his religious authority was limitless. He was never considered part of the order of the priesthood, in the strict sense of the word, and despite all of the imperial rituals that were endowed with religious significance. Constantine the Great, from 306 to 337, being the emperor, called himself a bishop over the outside, but this was only a matter of speaking. It was rumored that Heraclius, who was the emperor from 610 to 641, when victorious over the Persians and returning the wood of the cross to Jerusalem, had become a priest. But the story lacked all foundation. Leo III, who is the emperor from 717 to 741, declared, "I am emperor and priest," hence the title of Gilbert d'Agron's book. But he was an iconoclastic heretic. And Leo VI, who rules from 886 to 912, was said to have held the rank of reader or deacon, but only according to certain Arab writers seeking to explain why his fourth marriage had been prohibited. In general, with the gradual baptism of the empire and its increasing identification with Christianity, present and future, its ruler became the manager of an economy of salvation. A manager of an economy of salvation. The emperor was recognized as possessing or exercising a sacred function from God, where all power was delegated by Christ, who manifested himself by designating the anointed for the empire of Christians. The sacred function was exercised outside of the sacerdotal domain, outside of the priestly domain, and modeled metaphorically on Old Testament types such as Saul, David, and Solomon, viewed as predecessors of the Vasileps, or emperor at the head of a chosen people. In this sense, an emperor could be seen as having the legitimacy of the new David, who was the anointed second king of Israel, and the fairness of a new Solomon, who was the son of David, or denounced as having the blindness of a new Ahab, whose reputation for blindness was based on his confrontations with the prophet Elijah. With the exception of Constantine the Great, the emperors were not looked upon as saints, but rather as participants in sacred history, which went back to the time of the kings of Israel, Moses and Abraham, and as men whose conduct was to be judged in terms of morality or piety. In this role, for the empire of Christians, the emperor was responsible for implementing conciliar decisions. He also legislated in disciplinary and administrative matters affecting the church, even against the will of patriarchs and metropolitans. In other words, he was responsible for providing good government. The emperor was also concerned with the suppression of heresy, protecting orthodoxy. And where emperors did intervene to solve doctrinal issues, monothelitismos, or iconoclasm, if they deviated from doctrine, their rulings were repudiated, and the Orthodox faith was reestablished by a council, obviously Second Nicaea takes place in 787 with regard to iconoclasm. In this context, the Orthodox Church inherits imperial legislation as an important source of canon law. This legislation includes provisions that govern marriage, divorce, monastic houses, ecclesiastical organization, and so forth. It is no mistake that the central canon law collections of the Byzantine period bring together ecclesiastical and imperial legislation. These are known as nomocanons, in which nomi, laws, and canones, canons, are set out. As I said, the most important surviving example includes the nomocanon in 14 titles, which developed over time throughout the life of the empire, beginning in the 7th century, and is attributed to St. Photius the Great, whose memory we celebrate today. And another important example is the alphabetical collection of Matthew Vlastidis that we've mentioned several times, that canon law encyclopedia written in the 14th century by this hieromonk of Thessaloniki. The nomocanons make clear theoretically a central point regarding the church's view on imperial laws. Where the laws and canons contradict themselves, the canons are given preference. It is also no mistake that the church's attempts to clarify the conflicting and complicated rulings of its ancient tradition through major projects in the 12th century involving commentary on its received corpus of legislation were commissioned by emperors. For example, by Manuel I Komnenos for Theodore Balsamon to comment on 1,000 years of Christian legislation, or John II Komnenos for Alexius Aristinus to provide a commentary on the synopsis of the canons, variously attributed to a number of authors, and that these efforts involved the integration of imperial laws into the commentaries with the aim of making them relevant as well for various points of the church's life. On the other hand, the church's bishops and synods become increasingly involved in the late Byzantine Empire with questions not properly ecclesiastical in nature, informally the province of civil officials, for example, property disputes. And this occurs for a number of reasons, among which is the disintegration of imperial rule. It's reflected in a number of decisions of bishops' courts, such as those of Demetrius Komatianos. These decisions deal with not only questions of marriage and ecclesiastical relations of Latins, but also with disputes and claims over vineyards, for example. There's also, on the other turn, the other part of the church's, there is another side to this with the increased formal participation of the church clergy in the judicial system of the empire as imperial judges. Now, I'd like to speak to something that we need to understand regarding the Orthodox Church and the Byzantine or Roman state. Often, the role of the emperor is especially viewed by modern Protestant scholarship as being Caesaropapist. Not only Protestant, but Roman Catholic scholarship is also kind of involved in that too. But I think, and Gilbert Dagron does a great job of tracing it, one must understand the origins of this term as being created by Eustace Henning Bohmer, who lives from 1674 to 1749, a professor at the University of Halle in Germany, present-day Germany, who devoted a passage in his manual of Protestant ecclesiastical law to what he considered two principal abuses of power in religious matters. One he termed papal caesarea, and the other caesaropapia. In order to denounce in the name of the Reformed Church, the Pope, who was viewed as arrogating to himself political power and lay sovereigns who assumed responsibility for religious matters. Of these two expressions, only the second one caught on. It was increasingly used in the second half of the 19th century, less as a theoretical notion than as a target insult against Byzantium and its heirs, the Orthodox Church, identifying the intervention of the emperor as the principal reason for the schism between Christian East and Christian West, and pushing to the point of incompatibility a distinction made between the spiritual and the temporal, with the result of making it impossible for those who succumb to this anachronistic thought to truly understand medieval Byzantium and the role of the emperor. So, are there any questions about this point? I'd like to open it up for a little discussion.
So, would they all want him, the Byzantine emperor, to be like Charlemagne?
Let's put it this way. There wasn't never a constitution for the Byzantine state, a constitution about the transfer of power and the division of authorities. But you could encapsulate it this way. If there were to be a constitution for the Byzantine state, it would be the Old Testament. The Old Testament. That would be the constitution. And the emperor would be regarded as, like the kings of Israel, the head of a holy people, the empire of Christians, and the administrator of an economy or a apparatus for the salvation of the people. That did not make him a saint, that did not make him a priest, but it certainly did not, within this way of thinking, for the church, it did not neatly divide things up into the worldly and the spiritual, which is the thing that is that Bamer is up to, or Bomer. He is making it impossible, because of these anachronistic categories that he comes up with, to truly understand what is going on within the Eastern Roman context and the way the church accepts this good government of the emperor, including divorce legislation. There's no protest. There's a whole body of Cappadocian legislation or thought, canons, that deal with marriage and adultery and fornication. And that, what happens is the church comes to accept that a narrative in which this legislation was necessary during a time in which the empire did not specify grounds for divorce. It was based on mutual. It could be based on mutual consent for divorce. The emperor, in his role as in his legitimate role in leading the empire as a matter of a Davidic king, provided for good administration by specifying the grounds of divorce that then the church accepts without any protest and comes to apply the Cappadocian legislation to the clergy. It comes to apply that legislation to the clergy, and then for the laity, it accepts this whole idea of divorce and dissolution of marriages, and we have that inheritance in the various local Orthodox churches today, regarded as not illegitimate, and the basis upon which divorce occurs. So, imperial legislation, and this is painful to the ears of some, is actually a legitimate source of canonical legislation, and we actually inherit many canonical standards from imperial legislation of all sorts. The Noma Canon of 14 titles, is the central collection developed over a millennium and accepted by the church as a central source of its canonical standards. But keep in mind the rejection of any law, nomos, that would be contradictory to a canon. So there is a rejection. Not everything is taken uncritically. And certainly that idea of the emperor could be the new Ahab, could certainly be the new Ahab. He is a participant in sacred history, but he is not a priest. And he certainly is not a hierarch of the church. But it's an important point. Any other? Yes.
I'll just speak up from here. There have been many people who have criticized precisely the point you made, namely our dependence as a church tradition on the imperial period for drawing inspiration for today.
Yeah.
This is a very serious and long-standing critique. You know, it's been mounted now for over 100 years.
Right.
Would you comment? I mean, this is a huge issue, and I know you can't cover the whole thing, but would you maybe just delineate some of the pitfalls that lie in front of us with that way of thinking? Maybe, and
well,
also maybe some of the problems.
The central. So let me see if I got. I want to play back the question.
Okay.
What are the pitfalls in the charge that is made against us as being Caesaropapist? And the pitfall, the fundamental pitfall that the people fall into that make the charge, is that they are being anachronistic. They are projecting ideas about the separation of spiritual and material, of state and church, that did not exist at the time of the Eastern Empire. And so it makes it impossible to understand the role of the emperor as leading the holy people of God in this respect. And so the people that are making the charge obviously are coming from the Reformation. Yeah. And it only is Caesaropapism, the whole concept is only, and I think Dagron proves it very well, and I do recommend the book, Emperor and Priest. It's only been around since the 17th century, early 18th century. It hasn't been around all that long, but it is used against us. It is used against us.
May I follow up with one more follow-up?
Sure.
This is where a certain delicate area lies exposed, and that is, how does the calling of a pan-Orthodox synod take place in the absence of civil authority competent to do so in the long-standing history of the Anglican period and so on?
This comes to the fore whenever the church has to deal with a crisis. When it deals with a crisis, it comes to the fore. We're unable to summon an ecumenical council. The assumption is made, you know, we can't summon an ecumenical council, or there's problems in doing so. So what can we do? And there's been various thoughts about this. One thought that was put forward by the Holy Synod of Montenegro in the early 20th century was an exchange of opinion which involved the autocephalous churches, the majority deciding the issue with Constantinople and Russia being among the majority. That would be a type of ecumenical council. That relies upon majority rule, first of all, and it also reviles upon a certain conception of primacy about Constantinople, and it also relies upon numbers in terms of Russia. And one more thing it relies upon is reception. that in fact, whatever decision is being made by majority will be received by all the local churches without any rupture in communion, signified by not rupture in communion among them. That's one way of thinking about it. There have been some other very creative approaches as well, but it seems to me there is really no substitute for the local churches coming together in a council that involves all of them. One other solution is that a local church could take a decision that might be different from what is going on right now, but it would be based on scripture and prior canons that may say that you can do that. And that the understanding, this was put forward again in the early 20th century, the idea behind that would be that there would have to be, everyone would understand that each local church could do this without, again, this would be received by churches, local churches, and that they would permit variance. And this kind of thinking leads to, in fact, the calendar issue. Pan-Orthodox Congress of 1923, you have representatives come together. You have Ecumenical Patriarch, Greece, Cyprus, Montenegro, and you have some representation for the Church of Russia is very disputed. Anastasia of Kishinev and Alexander of America come, but they're regarded as ex officio representatives of the Church of Russia. Tikhon is under house arrest. At the time, 1923, they make a decision about introducing a new calendar, not the Gregorian calendar, but they engage in calendar reform, and their solution is similar to what I've just said. Each local church can be free to adopt or not adopt it. The rationale that they use is that what they're doing is something similar to Nicaea. They're trying to, the idea is that they're trying to put forward a calendar for Christians, and they're saying that it did not have a theological import. They're asserting that, and it's just simply a matter of a very practical issue, and churches are free to adopt it or not adopt it with the understanding that the decision would eventually be discussed at a future ecumenical council. And to some extent, they're successful in that there is no rupture among the local churches over the issue. So it seems to be acceptable, this solution. However, there are ruptures within local churches over the issue. And so within Greece, there's quite a bit of controversy, for example. You have monks preaching against the new calendar. I just translated one over the weekend. Monk Ignatius, writing in 1924, protesting vehemently against the new calendar and recording that, in fact, he understands an abbot has been led away in shackles by the civil authorities for maintaining the use of the old calendar. It brings up some very interesting points. So those are different ways of approaching the issue. Sorry to give you I hope you don't mind a longer answer, but I thought it was interesting. Okay. Yes?
You mentioned something about some churches are still following the old calendar.
Yeah.
In Greece?
Well, no, so something to understand. We're talking about in Greece, there is a group that has broken communion with the Church of Greece, They broke communion in the 1920s, and they established a true Orthodox Church. Uhoch, that's what I was talking about before. Well, at first they did, but they did have, they have people claiming to be bishops that, and they're a small group. There's a group in Bulgaria, for example. There's a group in Romania. So between the churches, so you have the Church of Greece, which adopts the Reformed calendar in 1924 for the calculation of immovable feast days. They do not adopt the Paschalion that is done by the Pan-Orthodox Congress of 1923. And you have the Church of Russia, which never adopts the new calendar. And the Church of Serbia, and it's one of the great ironies, the architect of the reform was actually Serbian. They don't adopt the new calendar. So does that make it clear? And so, but the idea is they're punting the decision. They're saying, okay, you're free to do this based on those two criteria. It's in scripture, it's in some canon of the, one of the 770 canons of the church says this. And the understanding we have is that there will be no break in communion, and then the decision will be made later by a ecumenical council. All right. So, anyone mind if I proceed? Any other points? Okay. I do want to talk about another theme, and this is the theme of the authority that is traditionally ascribed to various sources of inherited corpus of Byzantine canon law. And I've talked about the sources. Do I need to talk about it again? Scripture, apostolic canons, local councils, ecumenical councils, and patristic writings attributed authority. Several important points have to be made, though. And if we look at them with critical scholarship, none of these sources simply appear with full authority. They gradually gain acceptance by the church as consistent with pre-existent truth. This includes the scripture, the canon of which is in fact determined by councils of the church. The fundamental insight is that the church's confidence in the Holy Spirit's guidance allows it to accept or reject canonical sources when accepting or rejecting their authority and applying them to her historical circumstances. Consequently, regarding the authority of ecumenical councils, no council can simply proclaim itself ecumenical without also, and they do, there are councils that proclaim themselves ecumenical, without also being accepted or received as such by the whole church, including all the baptized and chrismated. Among scholars, there are certain historical characteristics commonly attributed to ecumenical councils. They include large amounts of bishops, representative character, at times the conviction of the council is ecumenical. But just bear in mind that if we just go about these externals, and not by the recognition of and the reception of the council as being ecumenical based on the life of the Holy Spirit within the church, by these external standards alone, the Vatican II could be regarded as an ecumenical council because it has worldwide representation, lots of bishops, but it's certainly not accepted, received within our church as ecumenical. Again, the authority of local councils are linked to the reception of the church, particularly by the two manifested in two canons that I've mentioned, Canon 2 of the Council in Trullo and Canon 1 of Nicaea. Another point that has to be made with regard to history is that the texts of canonical decrees are sometimes a compilation of canons from several councils. In the case of Laodicea and the African Coat. Even in the case of ecumenical councils, the seventh and eighth canons of the Council of Ephesus are actually added later and derived from the Council's Acts. Do any of these, are we afraid of any of these points brought up by critical scholarship as Orthodox? No, no, not at all. Because in fact, they are received by the church as reflecting holy tradition. They are received by the church as reflecting holy tradition, by all the baptized and chrismated, by the hierarchs of the church. So even it is completely, completely irrelevant for us in terms of holy tradition, whether the canons 7 and 8 of the Council of Ephesus were added later. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. It is, all of this points out the need to, of course, accept the truth, to examine the canons critically, but at the same time, not to deny that the church's reception reflects an acceptance of them as expressing holy tradition and the authenticity of teachings and Orthodox canonical standards. And I do want to bring up, and this is particularly applicable to the apostolic canons. We know for certain that they were not actually written by the holy apostles. Does that mean they do not express the mind of the holy apostles? That they do not express the holy tradition? Absolutely not. It has nothing to do with the question. They're received by the church as, in fact, an authentic expression of its tradition. I do have to mention a variance that you might want to be aware of, and this is with regard to Theodore Balsamon, Patriarch of Antioch. He actually believes there to be 9 ecumenical councils, not 7. And he accepts a council called the First and Second Council in 861, and also a council called Holy Wisdom, held in 879 and 880, both related, and this is very appropriate to say today, both related to Saint Photius the Great. Now, I did want to mention these points because it's extremely important that we did not deny critical scholarship, that we do not deny the reality of historical development. But what we affirm is, in fact, our belief in the Holy Spirit's life within the church and the reception of these canonical sources, even though they may have developed in different ways, as expressing the true holy tradition. A very important point, and one I think we need to keep in mind, and that means we are not prevented from reading scholarship. We're not prevented from reading scholarship. We just read it in a way that is within the context of the faith of the church. I do want to mention one other theme in the history of the legal development of the church, in the legal history of the church. And this is the development of additional sources of canonical legislation in the rulings of hierarchs and synods and the development of later works of application. And there are a number of them. It grows. There's a development of additional sources of canonical legislation grows, especially during the late Byzantine period. And during this time, they share a common problem with us. They have this received corpus that appears to be out of date and often refers to persons and institutions no longer in existence, penitents, deaconesses, various heresies such as the lapsi in North Africa, which we've discussed, but and also conflicting with a number of remedies, medicinal remedies for the same problem, and that are difficult to be understood because they're written in a language that no longer is current. And one way that they address these difficulties are through or undertaken by hierarchs in patriarchal synods and producing rulings. And most prominently those done by the Patriarchate of Constantinople in its standing synod. Even after the Turkish conquest, this role continues for Constantinople. Its rulings of the synod continue to be influential for the entire church's canonical applications. And they involve a whole series of complex questions, including philosophical questions. But most prominently, they involved marital legislation. The Church of Constantinople is certainly involved in the production of a great deal of marital legislation during the late Byzantine period. And this is the period in which we have the great commentators of Byzantine canon law, which in the commentaries themselves are another source of canonical legislation and standards. Theodore Balsamon, Zonaras, Aristinos are all producing these commentaries. But in addition, I'd like to highlight one more source. And these are, I think, often overlooked. These are the canonical answers. The canonical answers, series of questions and answers, draws upon an old Roman tradition of the antecessores, as they're called, the legal. This is sort of the legal professor. This is something that is rooted in the practice of official opinions in Roman civil law. And there's a whole series of questions and answers. What is their significance? What makes them so inviting? They are the pastoral manuals of the church. They deal with nitty-gritty, nuts-and-bolts problems, often dealing with liturgical practice, often dealing with the conditions at hand, and reflecting what is going on, how to properly celebrate Easter without implying that Satan has any role more than he is consigned to, and whether marriage, second marriage, should be crowned, and what is the audience for these pastoral manuals? The clergy. They're all attributed to bishops. I thought we might read a couple of excerpts from one of them, or two of them, in order to get that flavor. Finally, we have that canon law encyclopedia I've mentioned a couple times. But here's the important point, that these things can be looked upon as very positive in that the church is continuing its creative life in addressing the society, the circumstances it finds itself in on the basis of its tradition, of the truth. It's manifesting the truth, and you have this large production of works. But on the other point, and this goes to Father Patrick's question, it also points out something that is a negative, because what eventually happens is the increasing inability of the church to find some formal means of legislating, that in fact it has an inability to call an ecumenical council. One might argue that with the schism, great schism, with the division between East and West, maybe this plays into it. But if we accept there to be 7 ecumenical councils, or if we accept there to be 9, nevertheless, the formal means of legislating does not appear apparent, and we end up with some problems in receiving the formal corpus of canon law. So there is a positive and a negative involved in all of this. I think we're, how are we on time? It's 4:15? What time do I have up to? What? 4:30? Do we have time for a discussion of receiving Latins in communion? We'd like to do that? I have a canon law study. In your handout, in those that have the book, page 25, is an example of this is an example of one of those pastoral manuals, questions and answers. And I thought it most appropriate to do one from a patriarch of framed by a patriarch of Antioch. The admission of Latins to communion. So, Patriarch of Antioch, Theodore Balsamon, is called upon because basically the bishop that was asked to do so before him did not do a good job. His name was John Kastimonitis, and he was asked to frame some answers to Alexandria. There's Patriarch Mark of Alexandria that's come to Constantinople. Alexandria is under Islam, and they're having inability to answer fundamental questions about marriage legislation, which is exploding, literally exploding, under the being very creatively done under the Patriarchate of Constantinople. And Constantinople is the only patriarchate that's not under Muslim domination. And is not under all the restrictions in learning and worship and so many other things. And so there's a turning to Constantinople by Patriarch Mark, and he visits and he presents a 66 questions, of which one is question 16. And the question, Latin prisoners and others are coming to our Catholic churches. Who's the Catholic Church? It's us. And seeking to partake of the sanctified elements. What are those? The Eucharist. We seek to learn whether this should be permitted. The Crusaders, they're captured by Saladin, and they're captives. They want us to receive communion. They see their fellow Christians, but there's a problem. They're Latins. They're not Catholics. So what do we do? The response, and I'm going to point out something. I'm going to revise my translation a bit. The Holy Gospel states, this is how we respond, he who is not with me is against me. And he who does not gather with me scatters. Therefore, since many years ago, the formerly renowned assembly of the Western Church, we speak of Rome, separated from the communion of the other four holy patriarchs, and things alien to the customs and dogmas of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox were excluded. For this reason, neither in the holy sacred rites is the Pope deemed worthy of the general commemoration of names, nor should a member of the Latin nation be sanctified by a priestly hand through the holy and undefiled mysteries unless he first promises to refrain from Latin dogmas and customs. Now I'm going to change the translation because I truly think I mistranslated. Is catechized according to the canons, because that is the Greek word that's being used there. Catechized according to canons and is made equal to the Orthodox. So, catechized according to the canons. So, based on the text, what is the definition of the Catholic Church in the Latins? Catholic Church consists of what? The communion of what? Four holy patriarchates. And it has holy and undefiled mysteries and is Orthodox. Latins are part of whom?
Rome.
Western Church. More specifically, Rome, like you said. They don't share in what? The communion of the Catholic Church. They have customs and dogmas that are described as what? Alien to the Catholic Church. Okay. What would you define the problem as for Patriarch Mark? Should communion be given to whom? Would we say Latins? Or would we say non-Catholics? People who are not Catholic, right? Should we give communion to people who are not Catholic? How does Balsamon solve the problem? Can someone speak up? It's pretty obvious, I think. What?
Make them Catholic.
Yeah, they can't receive while they're what? Latins, right? But once they are made equal to the Orthodox, become Catholic, they can receive the Eucharist. Before they become equal to the Orthodox, what do they have to do? They have to, what? What? They have to be catechized and refrain from what? The Latin dogmas and customs. So there are variances in fundamental articles of faith. He's saying there's a fundamental article. When he says dogma, he's talking about some, you know, the articles of faith of the ecumenical councils. So, my question, is this solution still being used today?
Yes.
Yeah? How so?
We just received a couple. I'm not sure those people know. We're from the Catholic. Part of the initiation is we have to announce the Latin customs.
So I guess the question I have, being made equal to the Orthodox involves renouncing dogmas and customs and receiving instruction.
And that's actually the rite of initiation.
All right, but does it involve anything else? There's nothing else in here. Does it mention baptism?
No.
Do they have to be baptized?
No.
They have to be chrismated? They have to simply do confession of faith? Are all three of these ways being used in the Orthodox among the local Orthocephalous churches today to receive Catholics? What? Well, yeah, it is. It is certainly over the place. But I guess my question is this answer in terms of Latins, is this a canon? Do we have any canons based in those four sources, holy, apostles, ecumenical councils, local councils, and patristic writings recognized as having canonical authority, in other words, the formal corpus of canon law, 770 canons, are the Latins treated in that someplace? Yes?
Is it possible that this is a non-binding precedent?
Nope. No, no, don't confuse, we can't do that. That's, I would not say this is non-binding.
Is it still based upon a canon from earlier when dealing with...
I think you're on to something.
Back, you know,
how do we handle heretics and schismatics? Are the Latins being treated as heretics and schismatics in some way, shape, or form? I would put it to you, yes, they are. We're simply applying something here to them. Is this still the operative sort of way we're treating them? I would say yes, it is. Roman Catholics continue, Latins continue to be excluded to communion until being made equal to the Orthodox. Is that universal among all autocephalous churches? Yes. Yes. They're not receiving communion until they're made equal to the Orthodox. At least to my knowledge. Anyone know anything different? Yes, you know something different.
Is there a distinction between Latins and non-Latin Catholics?
You mean, in other words, can you be Catholic and be and use a now this is interesting. In the same answers, Balsamon is asked about Armenians, for example. And he's asked about people that worship using Syriac. And he's being basically asked, or not Balsamo, but the great church, is being basically asked, can this take place? Can they worship as Catholics? And the answer is yes, they can. But he makes sure that he says, but the liturgical, the celebration, has to be carefully translated into those languages. So, which seems to me to mean that there is a possibility of different liturgical celebration. So is it necessarily Western that's bad in the sense of a different liturgical language and rite? Or is it Latin, things that are alien, dogmas and customs that are alien to the Catholic Church? And isn't that the main criteria, the Catholic Church, that things that are consistent with Catholicity? So the answers are, you know, they're side by side. Yes.
So in this context, this canonist from Syria is saying we're going to receive these folks this way, you know, not necessarily by any sacramental means, but by a confession of Orthodox faith.
That didn't say that.
Oh,
it just says be equal to the Orthodox.
Okay, to the Orthodox like us.
Yeah.
Does that have any implications for how he would have seen the reality of sacramental life within the Latin Church at the time? Would he have seen, do they have real baptism? Or is it just, it looks like baptism, and then when they are received and made like us, whatever that may mean, then whatever form happened before is somehow validated.
What I think is really interesting to take a look at, this is where he speaks about the Catholics in this work. I mean the Roman Catholics,
yeah.
The Latins.
Mm-hmm.
But elsewhere, he is talking about the Copts.
Mm.
And he has interesting answers with regard to the Copts. And that's where I think you get to his thinking about whether there's baptism or there isn't baptism, whether there is priesthood or there isn't priesthood. And I think there is revealed how he views people outside of the Catholic Church.
Mm.
I think that demands more study. I've translated the entire work. The book is available.
You can't give us like a 30-second synopsis, can you?
Yeah. It's not the 30-second thing, but I have translated it. I intentionally made it cheap, so it's only $13. Advertisement. And I just recommend you read it for yourself, and then we can discuss. It's good to look, before we begin to discuss something like that, it's good to look at the text and then see what you think and see if I'm correct, because I footnote everything and I have what I think about what's going on there and in the preface.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I take it that this would apply equally to Roman Catholics and Byzantine Roman Catholics. Is that correct?
I don't make a distinction. They're all Latins to me. Sorry. I guess that's the way I look at it. I mean, when they show up at the Orthodox Catholic dialogue, I think, do they really know who they are? You know? I was in a discussion, and they, you know, I look at the website of one of the participants of the Orthodox Catholic Dialogue. He puts himself forward as an Orthodox in communion with Rome, and then he has on his website of his parish a defense of the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary. So just what does that mean? Naturally, this, you know, I don't want to, this is a sensitive sort of thing, given that the Western missionaries split the Patriarchate of Antioch into two in the 18th century, that it was a very deliberate action, that it was the result of a concerted missionary attempt by the Sacred Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith. And it's a sore issue to send missionaries to a Christian people. So it's something I have considered very carefully, especially when I wrote the preface to the writings of St. Raphael Hawini, who wrote his work, his thesis, as a defense against this type of thing, which was very active during his time. Now, things have changed. And if you notice, when I wrote the preface to the doctoral, the thesis of St. Raphael, I trace the change in Orthodox Roman Catholic relations, but I don't say anything about the Protestants, because I truly believe that in most cases that hasn't changed, that they're quite willing to send missionaries to our people and take them away from Holy Tradition. Yeah. You are edging your way. It is 4:30. Thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate everybody's attention.